You're listening to the Scottish Football Forums podcast, the home of Scottish football banter.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Scottish Football Forums podcast. I'm John and we have a book special tonight with Christmas coming up in a few weeks. It might be a wee idea for one or two people. And we have our book specialist, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm good, John, good. Nice to be back on again. Twice in a week, John will go mad.
I know, it's, your appearances are like buses, we wait ages and then two come
and
at once.
And then they all come at once, I don't know. Crazy.
It must be hard being a busy man.
That's it.
So, as I say, we've got two authors on tonight. First one, author of Behind the Curtain of the Beautiful Game and host of Football CFB, Callum McFadden. Callum, welcome back to SFF. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, John. Always a pleasure to join you and the team on the show, and delighted that it's you and Scott tonight. F-bomb not making an appearance, which is disappointing, but we'll catch up with him soon.
Yeah, I'll pass on the best wishes to John. I'm sure we'll get him to invite you on at some point. And we have someone from our good friends at the SFSA, Scottish Football Sports Association, co-author. Is it co-author or the brains behind this project? Back of the net, it's Donald Stewart. Donald, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, John, for having us on. And it's been co-edited, apparently. Paul Goodwin, one of the founders of the SFSA, I think he just corrected my spelling and put a few semicolons in because he's quite good at them. And I edited the contributions that were sent in by the 49 people who have submitted why they love their club in Scotland. So yeah, it's been a good project, and unfortunately I have to say that Paul Goodwin was the brains behind that, but I use the word brains obviously advisedly.
Well, that's good that you admit the contribution. I mean, Paul's also been on this podcast a few times. So, see, when you say 49, is that all the clubs in the SPFL set up, or how did it come about?
All apart from one. Bonnyrigg Rose don't have a contribution. We also got one from the Tartan Army, and we have some from lower league clubs like Gowton Beath. And Kirky Rob Roy and Whitlands Victoria. So, and also one for it was an under 15 player from Cumbernauld Colts who wrote about his love for his club. So, we had hoped to have all 42, but because of delays and COVID and all the rest of it, we just ended up with 41. We couldn't find somebody in Bonnyrigg Rose who was going to put pen to paper for us.
So, how many years has this project been in the making then? If you're talking about COVID, which was 3 years ago.
Yeah, it was a couple of years. I mean, it came out of COVID because we thought, how would we want to celebrate? And it, I suppose in a sense, the idea of it is that the Scottish Football Supporters Association have got thousands of members, and one of the ways in which to get people to recognise, i.e. SFA and anybody who owns a blazer in the cupboard, just exactly the contribution that supporters make, is to not only rap their door every now and again, but also to produce something. It's a highly positive reminder of just exactly why supporters are important in our game.
So what kind of challenges did the book present?
I think the first one was getting people to write for it. It took a little bit of while to get the momentum going. And then it was very much fits and starts. Because, you know, those people who... And it's interesting because I think the ones that came in quicker were the lower league clubs within the SPFL. And I think because often their sense of community is perhaps a little greater. I think for some of the ones up in the Premiership, that people felt that perhaps there might be a club historian or somebody else who might want to contribute. But thankfully, through a lot of personal contacts, people were asked and contributed. And obviously, there are three in there that are notable. Former Prime Minister, notable former First Minister, and a current sitting MP. So, you know, you get a little bit of the headline, but actually the more important ones don't just tug at the heartstrings, but are quite incredible, are the ordinary fans, including a guy who ended up being sent up to be the manager of a TSB branch, went along to represent the company and is now a 68-year-old supporter of the club that he was up to see, which I'm just checking my wee notes here to find out which club it was. It's one of those things where you start a story and you get halfway through and you go, where was it? Where was it? At Cove Rangers, of all places. So, you know, you get those, you get a certain Mrs. Buchan who got interested because her dad had joined. You get a Mrs. Kader who got interested because her son joined at Forfar. So there's a huge array of different experiences and different reasons why ordinary supporters love their football club.
How much did you enjoy reading these stories then? That must have, you know, especially with coming out of COVID and stuff like that, it must have kind of really been nice to find out these stories.
Loved it. And, you know, a lot of people do that thing, you know, I was honoured and privileged. Actually, I was. Some people have written of the loss of a father who they used to go to watch games with. There was a couple like that. And it was women, daughters, who had formed that kind of special bond. And also how they had helped, not just in the recovery process over a period of time that was particularly challenging, but also, you know, the kind of just the wee sparks of hope that you get from people who still believe, you know, that their club is going to at some point do something special, but also that it didn't matter so much. What mattered was the camaraderie, the going along, the being part of something. And it's certainly been part of my journey because I bagged my club, which is Ayr United, and told the story of why I get involved in supporting the club when I was 8.
Did you find, because I've often found, so I've done a lot of interviews, video interviews with various different clubs down the leagues, a lot of end up being fans first, but volunteers, and they would do pretty much everything and anything around the ground if they could.
I think our club structure marches along through the pockets of the supporters and the hands of them as well. I mean, I don't know how many times volunteers have been called for a variety of lower league clubs to go in and paint things or to support in terms of manning a stall or turning the turnstiles or whatever it may be. And very often I think that the best clubs are the ones who recognise that they have not just got a fan base, that it's not a customer base because football isn't a business, that what they have is they have golden opportunities with people who just want to contribute because they've actually taken away from the existence of that club so much that they want to give something back in return. So you see that in some of the contributions in terms of that boy who went along and he was a, you know, his local TSB manager, and something must have caught him that made him go, you know, we should be contributing more than just turning up and handing over a cheque or something. We're in contact with their customer base and also the community.
I think that's been one thing that's almost come out of COVID. I mean, you saw when COVID hit and there was no football for, the Premiership clubs was, 4 or 5 months. And for lower league, it was, from between March and October, which is, 7 months, if I remember rightly. And then when they come back, there's no fans allowed at games and things like that. But during that time, you know, there was crowdfunding being set up. I know Albion Rovers and Raith Rovers were teams that raised a good few grand out, and they helped keep their clubs going. So I think that in itself spread the message about how important the fans are and how much they care about their club. Did that shine through in a lot of the stories that you were that you picked up and read and glossed over?
Yes, I think COVID was significant for all of us in terms of that desire to get back out into the open air and be amongst people. And one of the largest places that you can go and be amongst people is on a Saturday at 3 o'clock, traditionally, but also other parts during the, you know, the week. And watching it on any platform through television or your laptop is never going to replicate that. There needed to be some form of human contact. And I think that what was clear was, I think that nobody said COVID made me, but plenty of influences of feeling that ability to be back amongst people, to recognise who it was that was across the way, nodding to somebody who, you know, lives down the street, or whatever that connection may be, was something people relished and were desperate to get back to. It came through, I think, in terms of that emotional strength that many of them gave to following their football club. It wasn't just, you know, cheering when somebody hit the back of the net. It was also about cheering when you walked away from it and realised you get something very positive out of it, even when it was something very negative, which for many of us in the lower leagues, that can be a weekly occurrence. But, you know, you just felt that people wanted to celebrate being back in amongst it. And although it didn't come through as a very strong theme, the theme that did come through was that ability to be with each other.
And what was the thinking behind the title?
Well, you see, I had a sub-editor on that, and I think the idea, if I may speak on his behalf, which I will anyway without permission, was that it is about this as us scoring our own attempt to create that positivity. We're hitting the onion bag in order to prove to people that actually we're not only just still here, but there's a huge impact that football has on the Commonweal, on communities. The way in which, if we encourage people to come into football, that what we end up with is not only people who contribute, but the contribution they get back can help with mental health, can help with them working through any obesity crisis they may be in, looking at health-related issues, but also that simple connection, that human connection. So I think, I don't think it was an own goal, but I certainly think it was a suggestion that we have scored maybe in the 94th minute off Scott McTominay's backside when we need that goal to just make it a draw.
So both books, both yourselves and Callan's as well, is heavily contribution-led. How hard is it to get all those contributions? I know you kind of touched on you couldn't get Bonnie Reg and things like that. But for you and for yourself, Callum, how long a process do you find? Because, you know, we've all done these sort of things where we can get ghosted, we can get... It can be quite mentally challenging in itself.
Well, in terms of mine, you know, putting it together, I was fortunate that a few of the people within the book I'd spoken to before, so when I had reached out to them and asked them if they wanted to be involved in the project, they'd said yes quite quickly and I could count on them. The others that I hadn't spoke to before were just sort of names on a sheet of paper that you're hoping are going to say yes, you're hoping you're going to touch base with. And there had to be alterations, you know, from there where the names literally were penciled in until they'd said yes. So you're right, Scott, you know, you can get ghosted, you can get politely declined, which is always better than being ignored, and I would say in my experience. But yeah, once I had a list of names, I then had to whittle it down into something that I felt that casual readers would enjoy and football fanatics would enjoy. I didn't want to go too top heavy in either direction, and that's why I made the book all in it, but 160 pages, because I wanted it to be something that someone who loves football and adores football, just like all of us on this, can pick up and enjoy, but also someone who's maybe more of a casual fan or is just getting into the game can pick up and enjoy as well.
It's not just I suggest with, because I have got your book here to hand, and obviously as a bookseller, I think I see people coming into bookshops and they're just getting back into reading, or they've not really got into reading before. And I think having a book that's 160 pages long and is a bit about a kind of interest that grabs people like football, it's less intimidating. You know, there's nothing worse at the moment. Barbara Streisand's got a book and it's a tome, right? And it's selling well. People obviously love it. But it's huge, it's massive, and it's going to put people off. It's going to put off somebody who's just wanting to get back into reading. I think that there is a call for a kind of shorter book just to bring in people and make it more accessible, because people still are conscious of their reading ability. So I do think that there's definitely a market for a kind of short book like that that is accessible and, as you say, brings in people from a wider spectrum.
Yeah, as I say, I think that was my aim with it, because I could have went on and on and on and on, but I was also conscious that I wanted the stories and the contributors within the book to also have their stories shine. You know, I didn't want to have, say, 20 contributions from managers and 20 contributions from players or whatever it may be, because I didn't want it to lose its value. So I tried to keep the numbers relatively similar for some of the aspects. And then for things like fans, I had two in particular, completely different ends of the spectrum, one from Manchester United, one from Crystal Palace. And obviously with Palace down south, they've had a lot of trials and tribulations. And on the United side, you had lots of great chat about European adventures and great world-class players over the years. So I've tried to, as I say, find the balance, not only with the number of contributors, but the type of contributors as well. So Roy Hodgson's in the book, who managed England, has managed Inter Milan, and Dick Campbell's in the book, who's managed Arbroath and managed some of the Angus clubs. And I wanted to strike that balance that, yes, there are the glitz and glamour of the game is there, but there's also a real heart and a real community to the game, as Donald's rightly said throughout his contributions to the show so far as well.
Well, I noticed that more so in the... let me just find out which one it is again, so I want to get the chapter correct. Yeah, the anchoring of the game, you've got the Jeff Stelling, and then at the bottom you've got Jeremy Dead, who I kind of knew of years ago, before he was into the actual industry of football. And it is, as you say, it's that kind of widespread that, you know, you're not getting just the top end, you're getting every single kind of bit covered. And that's the good thing I think about your book, is that it is so well kind of plotted, that you're getting views from fans, from managers, from financing the game, from everything else. It's just, and it's, as I say, it's well plotted.
Well, on that one, as you say, with the example of Jeff Stelling and Jerry McDade, you know, Jeff's obviously worked for Sky for decades, and, you know, their production levels and the amount of money that they can put into their programmes is huge. They've shown that over the time that they've covered football across Europe and in the UK as well. Whereas with Jerry's example, he touches on what it was like working at Morton again, particularly during COVID, trying to set up streaming for fans, because obviously, as John said earlier, fans couldn't go to the games. And then when they could go to games, initially they were coming back in smaller numbers before things could get back to full capacity. So I wanted to, again, strike that balance of, this is what it's like working for an organisation like Sky that's around the globe, and this is what a community-led project is like covering football. Because even though there's different viewership, different money and different figures involved, both of them are similar and both of them are the same in the sense that they want to cover the game in a good light. And that's what I wanted to try and get across as well.
You're further on than I am, Scott. And I think I probably started before you as well. Just sums up where I'm at in terms of a busy lifestyle just now. But yeah, I think what I've found intriguing, Callum, is... You've done it in a question answer style format, which I think is quite interesting. It's different to how a lot of other people do it. You know, what was your thinking behind doing it in that way?
For me, my earliest memories of reading in relation to football were things when I was young, like Match Magazine, and as I gradually got older into sort of 442 World Soccer, and I always loved the A to Z type sections, or the quick fire question sections. And I wanted to, again, appealing to maybe the more casual reader, put it in a format that would be easy to follow, in the sense that you could maybe, there might be 10 people in the book that you're really interested in, and I wanted to make it so that someone could get the book, pick it up, read those 10 people and hopefully stay for the rest. Whereas sometimes if you are trying to pick something, as Scott said earlier, to a more casual reader, they might just look at the subject and go, do you know, that's not for me, I'm not going to give it a try. Whereas I wanted to make it a book that people could pick up and go through from start to finish all in the one burst, or could pick it up, read some, and then gradually come back to it as well. So that was the two main reasons behind it. And the other one would be, there was an author called Mike Carson who wrote a fantastic book, in my opinion, years ago called The Manager. So it was a similar idea to what I had put together, but his was solely focused on managers, given the title, as you can guess. And he had about, like, 10 or 15 chapters, different managers working at the elite level, lower leagues, community level, And I remember reading that book at the time. It was in association with the LMA down in England. And I remember reading it thinking, do you know, I really like the way that's been put together. It's not just one voice coming the whole way through. There's multiple voices and there's the elite, but there's also the grassroots, you know, and part to premiership type idea. So I wanted to do something similar, but put it across the whole spectrum of football, because as we all know, loving and following Scottish football, you know, there's great characters who've been in the dugout on the pitch, but also in the broadcasting sphere, or maybe even referees like Stuart Dougal was in the book. And I think sometimes we forget as fans that referees get really annoyed when they make errors. You know, it's their dedication, it's their elite level of performance. They're treating that seriously as possible, whereas sometimes we're in the terrace or watching it on the TV just demanding the best for our team, and maybe sometimes forget that. So I wanted to just cover all bases, and that's the way I tried to go about it.
And Donald, just as a kind of, because I've not had a chance, because I don't think the book's out yet, it's a wee teaser, so why Air United?
For me, because I come from here, and I lived in a household where my mother was an alcoholic and never found recovery. So getting out was a bit special. And my father took me to my very first game in 1973, Texaco Cup, Air United versus Leicester City. I was many years later able to find out who played that night. I knew that Peter Shilton was in nets, but I didn't know who was number eight for Air United. It was a certain Mr. Alec Ferguson. Wonder what happened to him. So that first night was something that just grabbed me. And we're talking about 1973, so we're not talking about a time where safety for children was necessarily at the forefront of many people's minds. So from the age of eight onwards, I went to the football myself, and I would get out my house at 2 o'clock, back at two, and walk from my house to Somerset Park. And in the description I've given of this walk, I went from a house that was not a home through the urban area and the park, which currently houses the home international championships for bowls. Then come through the other end, and then something happened when I came out of that park. I went into what was like a housing estate that was fairly dark, but not satanic mills type. But what I was walking through was cars that were parked, some of them up on the pavement. And this was the 70s. And then there was a noise, and it was like a wall. And if I was able to negotiate through that wall, what I found was a scarf or 50 or 100 or 1,000. And people. And people who looked at me as if I belonged, simply because the badge I wore was the scarf that was around my neck. And from there until 90 minutes was finished, I found a family that was non-judgmental, that didn't care what had happened to me that day, but cared about what was going to happen to me whilst I was there. It could be described as partly tribal, because I knew that if anybody came for me, I had several thousand people at my back. But also that feeling of just simply belonging without having to explain why I wanted to be there. And also the kindness of people, where they would go, do you want a lift over, son? And they just take you through and you get in for nothing. Until my mate, who bizarrely was called John Knox, his father worked, and his father was also called John Knox. No guesses, no prizes for guessing which club they supported when they came for Glasgow. But when you walked in, and again, you know, you go through the turnstiles, I'm sure every football fan has this, that particularly at the time before all-seated stadium, that you would walk in and then there would be an emergence of a view. And at Somerset, where I went in, there was a big banking that you had to walk up. And as you walked up, the sky became the top of the stand, became the stand itself, and became then something that was green and something that had two sides to it. And you knew which side was yours. Even when they decided to turn round at halftime, you knew which side you were going to afterwards. And all of that tradition, that if you knew, you knew, like why it was you only get pineapple sweeties on the terraces when somebody came round who looked as though they'd fallen out of some shelter somewhere in order to sell you, and why Bovril was an appropriate drink to go with something where the grease ran off your elbow when you were eating it. All of those things were part of just feeling. And as an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 10, as I grew until I went off to university, that was just something that was a saviour. Not as in it saved my life, I was, you know, or anything like that. Nothing that was overly dramatic. But in terms of something that just made you want to keep going back, that was it. Despite the fact that we only lasted one season in the Premier League. Really, we get chucked out after the second one. First one was good. But, you know, all of those things meant something. And even Argentina still means something to some of us, somehow.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned Alex Ferguson. What happened to him? Well, he became the Sterling manager the next year. After that, I don't know what happened.
It was his final season as a player. I just caught him at the tail end. Oh, he could have been a player, I'm sure.
Yeah. He actually had a no bad career. He didn't quite reach international honours, but certainly as a manager, did all right, I think. But yeah, I think that's important that you mentioned that, you know, you support a team that's local to you, that's, you know, you grab that identity straight away. And I think that's something that's almost lost in modern day football. Like, if you were to look at how little kids there are out in the streets or down at local parks playing football, there's very few compared to like our respective days. But any who are like wearing Man City shirts and Haaland and PSG shirts with Neymar and, you know, clubs that are just not identifiable with the working man these days. But you've also, but back in that day, it was more common for people to go and support the local team more often.
And I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's one of the things that when you get community clubs who are working in the communities. Now, use a specific example. I've spent many a year as a director and associate director of Ayr United Football Academy. And we're an organisation that runs the youth football for Ayr United. We're not part of the club. We're a separate entity, or a separate legal entity recognised by the SFA. And a number of different reasons behind all that. But the important thing is that you're absolutely right. When we run summer camps or we run Easter camps, most of the kids who initially turned up were in a couple of recognisable jerseys from Glasgow East and South, and also your Barkers, your Man Citys, your Arsenals, and so on. That lasted about a fortnight, because what we had was we had players from Ayr come in and support and help with the programme. And very slowly but surely, you saw people going, actually, you are my local club. I know who you are. That connection is made. And maybe next time round, my dad will get me the latest airstrip. We saw airstrips starting to appear. Not just airstrips, by the way, Cumnock Juniors, Talbot. That led to a couple of interesting conversations with the under-sixes. But, you know, all of those things as you develop, I think, is as you make that connection, you can actually fight back and see children and young people having an affinity. I mean, look at what we're talking about at the moment, where supporters are excluded from having a discussion about flares. Who's bringing them in? It's not the 45-year-olds. It's not the pensioners. There's nobody getting in with them scooters with a whole load of flares hidden in a basket somewhere. This is about young people wanting to bring some kind of atmosphere, interested in bringing that atmosphere. And a lot of them are not just, you know, the highlights are always going to be the Premiership clubs, but there are clubs like Peterhead, clubs like Ayr itself, clubs like Falkirk, who are talking about how they manage this as a phenomenon, because they have a large number of what are called ultras, because they're young people who want to get involved and want to be a part of their club, their local club.
The thing about, you know, I've done some bits and pieces with the Ayr United Academy as well, is it's not just the young people, you know, they think about the whole community as well. You know, up until walking football, so if you've got the full family involved in the club, then there's a greater chance of you keeping hold of them when the youngsters do, you know, come along.
it didn't work for me and my kids. I lost them, and I had plenty of kids to try and recruit. But it's that interesting thing, and it's interesting. I think you had alluded to before we come on, John, the chapter in Callum's book with regards to Mr. Brown, as I called him, Craig, because I was very fortunate in that I'm a trained teacher, and the very first lecturer I had who trained me was a certain Craig Brown. And it was his last few months as a lecturer before he went full-time at the SFA. And many years later, I was reporting at Somerset Park and coming out. My daughter, my middle daughter, Niamh, would normally come with me to games. And we came down and were coming out the front door, and there was Mr. Brown there. And I stood and I said, "Mr. Brown, you won't remember me," and started talking away. And Niamh's looking at me. And at the end of the conversation, as he was always very expansive and very welcoming and full of things to ask and be more concerned about you than you had questions to ask him, though he was clearly the most interesting person in the conversation. And as we left, Niamh turned to me and went, "Who was that?" So I went into my spiel and told her. And then at the end of it, she looked at me, "All right." I said, "Why do you ask?" She looked at me up and down. She went, "Dad, you never call anybody Mister when we go to the football." So it was a wee bit of a lesson there as to the language that certainly Mr. Brown would not have been in favour of if he had ever heard me. But, you know, it's interesting how those things happen. And again, you know, Niamh was my bag person. She came to most of my reporting gigs, but she never stuck the time.
Yeah, in terms of Craig, obviously, we're getting this stage of the year, we reflect on the year gone by and people that we've lost, and Craig is, without question, the biggest one in Scottish football that we've lost this year. Callum, you, with I did manage to get is that lovely tribute that you wrote to Craig in your book, and the bit I'm actually coming on to is his part in the book before he sadly passed away. You obviously, like, I think a lot of people, I'm in this as well. You developed a good friendship with Craig, not just in terms of your media stuff, but what did he mean to you overall?
He was just, you know, the gentleman of Scottish football. But even as you say, John, take all of the football away, he was just a gentleman. You know, he was someone who would ask how you were getting on. He would ask how your family were getting on. And, you know, he would take an interest in you. And as Donald rightly says, you know, he tells, you know, he's Craig Brown. He's achieved so much greatness in the game at club level, international level. He's worked with some of the best footballers the country's ever produced, you know, and you could listen to him all day, but he wanted to take the time to listen to you. And you mentioned this time of year. I found it quite poignant. I do the commentary at Celtic for the visually impaired supporters, and where we're based is right at the tunnel. And, you know, normally when I've been doing that now for about 3 years or so, Craig would always be in the with the Aberdeen directors. And when we played Aberdeen a couple of weeks ago, it hit me quite hard when I turned around, and normally you would see him come in and he would always have a comment, "Oh, look what you're doing now, you're doing well," or "Remember me when you're famous" type thing. He'd always have a quip for you. And when I turned around a few weeks ago and he wasn't there, that did particularly hit me, because he was just a great, you know, supporter of people, as well as a supporter of football and the various roles that he did throughout his life, you know, from being a teacher, he taught Andy Ritchie, who's another person in football who I've got a lot of time and respect for, and he was his teacher at school, and then obviously went on to work with him, you know. So it's an interesting story as to how, you know, Craig had an impact not only in the clubs that he managed or the national team, but so many people across football and even out with football, you know. Working in education, a few years ago I had a project and I reached out to Craig. I had two pupils who were tasked with interviewing someone within the local community who had a profile, and because I knew Craig well, I thought, "I'm going to ask him." The Euros were coming up at the time, obviously delayed to 2021, and I said, "Look, can these two kids send 5 questions to you and will you answer them?" And he said, "No, I'm not going to email them." He said, "I want to speak to them." So we managed to set up a video call. They both got to speak to him. They asked their questions, and they were just mesmerised. One of the wee boys, there was a boy and a girl involved, and the wee boy was a massive, massive Rangers fan. And he was just amazed that Craig Brown not only knew Ally McCoist, but had worked with him, because he'd heard his dad, his cousin, his older brother talking about Ally McCoist as this great player, and he had known him as the commentator and the pundit that we all know. And Craig, you know, was happy to take not only the 5 questions from each of them, so 10 questions altogether, but he was happy to continue speaking to them after they'd finished asking them and we'd finished the little recording that they were going to do for the school magazine, you know, and he was happy to answer all the questions. And again, took a genuine interest in them. You know, he wanted to ask them how they were, what their ambitions were they sticking in at school? And I used to work in school, so you better be sticking in type thing. And if you're not, Mr. McFadden will let me know type thing, you know. So he, for me, a massive impact, and someone that I'm just so proud to have known, you know, because, you know, I said it in the tribute. I mean, when I reached out to interview him, I hadn't really had a background of interviewing too many people at the time, and he could quite easily have just ghosted me, as you said earlier, Scott, or just replied saying thanks but no thanks. But nope, he gave me the time, spent a few hours on the recording, and then spent just an equal amount of time after it and stayed in touch ever since. So yeah, he meant so much, he really did.
That's funny you said that, Cal, because your story there reminds me of my first interaction with Craig Brown. I was a young child at the time, and he was the Scotland manager, and I thought Charlie Miller should be in the Scotland team, so I wrote to Craig Brown, sent it off to Hampden saying Charlie Miller should be in the Scotland team, this, that, and a few other questions, and I couldn't believe it. I got a letter back within a couple of weeks, and obviously this kind of dates me in terms of there was no such things as emails, so it was like a side picture from the team, this, that, and the next thing. And he said, yeah, Charlie Miller's a very good player. Hopefully he'll be in the team in the future. You know, but to take the time that he did, to obviously a school child who was passionate about football, and, you know, that made my whole entire year, that the Scotland manager took time out to write to me and to kind of agree with my points. And for him to have done that throughout his whole life is just tremendous.
Absolutely, and the fact that, as you say, Scott, he was doing that, you know, for decades. And the thing that was amazing about him as well is he never wanted any credit or any special attention or a pat on the back for it. You know, he kind of seen that as his duty and as a person. You know, he never had any ego. You know, he would just be happy to help out anyone. And John and I went to watch a game, Montrose versus Queen's Park, and His grandson was playing, and we were sending him a few messages during it, and he texted me after it saying, Beckham Brown played well today, didn't he? You know, so he was happy to open up about his family and personal things as well. He was one of a kind, he really was.
Yeah, he certainly was. Craig, may you rest in peace. What a tremendous man. Cal, we just have to mention that you're obviously raising funds for Manon and Brookley Charity, men's mental health charity, which is a good cause. What was the reason for you selecting them?
So I've been open about it over the years. I lost my father when I was 14, and that had a massive impact on me and my life, and it still does. So I've suffered with bouts of depression on and off over the last 14 years or so. I'm now 28, just done 28 this week, so yeah, it's a cause that's very close to my heart. And with the book, you know, for me, I always wanted to write a book. It was something I always dreamed of doing, you know, an aim of wanting to do it, but I never quite thought it'd be possible. So when I put it together, I thought I would like to give something back to mental health as a cause, because I've been supported, I've been lucky enough to have support from family, from friends, and from external people, you know. And I thought, I'd love to give something back locally as well. So Manon and Inverclyde were the charity that I turned to, because I see the great work that they're doing in the local area. They also have a service talk on Inverclyde, which is open to women as well. So they do great work throughout Inverclyde, and schools working with young people, working with people of all ages. And, you know, I think the work that they do is inspiring. And in this climate where everything seems to be getting cut year on year, whether that be from governments or grants, you know, I thought, even if I can help in a small way, I would love to do so, because I've been fortunate enough to have help when I've certainly needed it with my own mental health. And if I can raise enough money that it can help one person, I'll be over the moon. So that's why I decided to give back to a cause that means a lot to me and also to the local community as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing that you're doing there. Donald, I'm just going to bring you in this in terms of the mental health scenario, because it's something that was almost brushed over for decades, as you probably know. But how important is it now that we're now talking about this more often, and that it is okay to be okay? Because, you know, as we say, for a long time it was brushed under the carpet.
Absolutely. And you know, men had to be men and tough and not admit any kind of weakness. And yet, between the ages of 17 and 25, you are 3 times more likely to commit suicide as a boy, a man, somebody who identifies as male, than a woman. In fact, 3 times as many men commit suicide in Scotland than women do. And that key area between the ages of 17 and 20 odds is so important, because by that point you have absorbed the media, you have absorbed the culture, the idea that you should be roughy, toughy, big and male, and that kind of belief that anything that might be a struggle for you, might be a difficulty for you, might be something that you don't have control over, is a weakness. And you should be ashamed of it, and you shouldn't seek help. And that four-letter word that people avoid consistently and constantly, and is, and for many people, the worst four-letter word of all, help, is one that should be at the tip of everybody's tongue. And nobody should look around and look at anybody and say, "Aye, but, you know, way back in the day, I remember when we were carrying coal in our backs and we had to deal with everything and we had to do this and..." You know, you're just a load of snowflakes. There are no such thing. Do you know the biggest snowflakes? The biggest snowflakes are the ones who are talking when they talk like that, because they can't cope with the idea that there is a possibility that whilst their workmate, their friend, their family member has actually been suffering and has been screaming out by the way they behave, not by the way they speak, but by the way they behave, and they, instead of actually doing something about it, have ignored it. And by the way, I'm not setting myself up as some kind of paragon of virtue. I'm as complicit as that as anybody else, because I know, particularly within my own family and elsewhere, that there have people been suffering and have been standing next to me, and I've thought, oh, come on, adult up, man up, woman up, get on with it, deal with it, go on. And then eventually, when you find yourself in an existential crisis, or you find yourself standing there realizing that you may be the one who needs that kind of help, going, where is everybody? And the fact of the matter is that that culture that you have indulged in and you have been caught by and you have been engaged in has actually led you to a point where you're incapable of helping anybody, to the point at which you are only capable of accepting help. You can't offer any out because you're struggling too. And I think that the more we talk about it, the micro bits of it as much as the macro bits of it, let's talk about wee things that we can do to help rather than just concentrating on another headline that the Daily Mail or others of that ilk might want to put out there. It isn't about seeing the tragedies that happen and suggest that, you know, they might be mentally a little imbalanced, but actually looking at how we invest in, and I think applaud Callum, absolutely, any little bit that is put in is actually a signal to the person sitting next to you that they may actually decide to put themselves up for doing something in order to support. What is it? Who was it? It was the Chinese philosopher who said that the journey of 1,000 miles starts with a single step. If everybody took a single step, how far forward would we be? And I think that's the contribution that we all should be looking to make, and make sure that we make it, rather than talk about it, because it's dead easy to talk.
I think that one of the most important things, I think, when it comes to mental health is also listening and being approachable and accessible to people. I think it's... I think we all kind of take life too seriously sometimes, and we all try and think that we're all too busy to doing this, that, and the next thing. You know, I work in retail, and I know that some people come to the shop, will buy a book, and one of the biggest things about that is the interaction between myself and them. That's what it's for. It's for, you know, they'll enjoy the book. Don't get me wrong, they'll love the book. There'll be a reason for buying the book, but it's that interaction that they might not get for the rest of the day. And I think sometimes it's just listening to people and let them have that interaction, let them have, you know, we have to be able to listen. And if somebody is needing help, but they can't formulate the words, we should be able to now kind of identify certain things. You know, I can do it personally because I've struggled with mental health, so I can see where I'm going dips, and I can try and steer it away, and I know to try and do more exercise, be outside more, communicate more, whereas I used to just kind of sleep until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon and just not speak to anybody. So I think 100% speak out, and for everybody else, listen. Just take time out and just listen to what people are saying to you.
I think that first step's always the hardest as well. I mean, I've also been going through things recently, which I'll expand on another day. But, you know, I hit a point where I just had to say, right, I need to stop. I need to stop doing a few things and, you know, admit I've got an issue. And I've went and seen someone about it, and I'm now in a better place. And obviously, Calm's come through the other end, and obviously, writing his book now and stuff as well. So, yeah, I think, the phrase man up you use is something that really annoys me. I think man up actually should be you've been man enough or woman enough to admit you've got the issue and doing something about it rather than just bottling up, because that's the worst thing that you can do. So my message to people would be, if you've got a problem, just stop what you're doing and take that important step, because that could be a game changer.
The thing is, with people that say man up, it's the easiest thing to say. It's the easiest thing to get stay away from the problem, because they don't want to, it's almost like a reflection. They don't want to see that they've got issues. They don't want to know. Because everybody, to some degree or another, will have mental health issues. Whether it's severe, whether or not they understand it, everybody goes through it. And I think by saying man up, they're hiding from it rather than they don't want to discuss it, because then it kind of puts a mirror onto them and they don't want to kind of admit that they might actually also suffer from same sort of, whether it's fears, whether it's just life and how things are going in that moment in time, whatever it is, they don't want to then deal with it themselves. And that's why, as you say, John, that the kind of the hardest thing is to actually say, do you know what? I'm actually dealing with an issue, and I need help. That is the hard part of it. It's not just turning around to somebody and saying, oh, man up. You know, there's nothing hard about, you know, trying and desperately to get through life without saying something to anybody. You know, it's hard to actually say to somebody, listen, I need help.
Indeed, and I think that, you know, particularly those people who engage with that help, and you know, I alluded to earlier, my mother was an alcoholic. My mother was gracious enough to gift me that in her will. So I've been sober and clean for the last 32 years. And actually being in a position where, I'm not saying that because I want everybody to go, oh, well done you, because we have to walk, not just tall, but also with a degree of humility, because I'm only sober today up until I put my head in my bed, my head in my pillow. Tomorrow morning I start again. And that's something that is important, is the way in which people engage with those things. And I think that one of the problems that has been, and it's just a bit unfortunate, that some people have engaged with the mental health debate by using it as a cloak to defend their actions, as opposed to actually seek the help. And what it does is it stops people who genuinely need that help from often coming forward, because they see an association that comes from society that kind of looks down upon that. And I think that kind of behaviour, and I think that, you know, it's really important. I work in care during the day, and we've got 58 kids, all of whom have been through significant trauma. And because I'm the head of education, I'm dealing with a number of authoritarian figures who are sitting there giving it you know, I mean, we can't have him in here because he behaves like this. Ever thought for a second why? Ever thought for a second how people who have gone through significant trauma might have a difficulty with somebody shouting at them?
It's interesting that Donald mentions that age group. Calum, you were within that age group at one point when you were going through all this, obviously. You know, how much is this hitting home, and how proud do you feel that you've come through that end? And all right, you might still have the odd turn every now and then, but on the whole, you're in a much better place than what you were, say, 3-4 years ago.
Indeed, and I think given the time for me, I was 14, I was working towards my exams. After those exams, there was another set of exams. It was going to university, it was finished university. You know, it was plod on. I never took the time to think about it. And as you say, there was a perceived kind of weakness, or we don't talk about those kind of things. You know, you get on with things. And it got to the point for me where I had to stop, take stock of how I was feeling, what was going on, and seek help to address it, because, you know, I wasn't feeling good about myself. I wasn't getting joy from the things that normally give me great joy, and that was for me a big alarm bell. And as Donald says, you have to sometimes think why. You know, it's easy to constantly belittle yourself for how you're feeling, but it's about thinking why you're feeling that way sometimes as well. Now, sometimes you might not be able to explain that, but for me, taking that step back to think why helped me then seek the help to address all these things that I felt needed addressed to then get me into a better place. Whereas Scott mentioned earlier, I now feel when a dip is coming and I can gradually try and put things in place to stop it. Might not always stop it. You know, there might be some days, weeks, months that are harder than others, but on the whole, I can now regulate that much better than I ever could. And when I was that age group, as you say, John, when I went through the initial kind of trauma experience, I didn't know where to turn. And my way of dealing with it at that time was just focus on the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. But eventually you jump through all these hurdles, you get to the end, there's no more hurdles to jump, and that's when it hit me. So it's about being open to recognise any slight changes that you may have going on, and sometimes even just having a chat with a friend, you know, it doesn't always need to be going externally. Sometimes just having a chat with someone you trust about how you're feeling can be a great reassurance. And as Scott, you said earlier, listening is so important as well. You know, if someone takes the time to listen to you for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or even 2 minutes, you know, that could really make a difference to not only your day, but yourself going forward.
Yeah, thank goodness we're in this age where mental health is, the awareness is at a level that's never been at before and will continue to grow. So, yeah, we'll just keep, to anyone listening, just if you're suffering, don't suffer in silence. There is always someone that will listen to you. So just keep talking. Come back to your book briefly, Donald. We've only got a few minutes, so we'll just try and wrap up a few questions. But what I really wanted to, you mentioned your former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. Obviously, we know him as a Raith Rovers supporter. How did you manage to get in contact with him and sell him the idea to say, we've got this book, would you fancy contributing, to get him to then say, yes, I'm absolutely happy to help?
We are fortunate in that one of the major supporters of the Scottish Football Supporters Association, of course, is Henry McLeish, former First Minister, and he made, I believe, the contact, and I think it was through Gordon Brown still keeps an office, as in staff, so there was a, I think within various major political parties, there will be staff who are shared at various points and connections that are therefore made. So that was the route. And what I got back from, I didn't always speak directly to Gordon Brown's office, you certainly got the impression that he was more than delighted. He was actually very keen, because I think that, you know, even the insanity of being at a Raith Rovers match is not quite as insane as it being in Westminster or in Downing Street. So I think that there was a degree of sanity that was preserved by him at least looking for results coming out of Kirkcaldy on a fortnightly basis. So that certainly did come across. And Henry, his one, of course, he played for East Fife, and very proudly played for East Fife at a time where Methil was slightly more feared than it is now. But and indeed played at Hampden for East Fife. So there were lots of really golden memories in there. I wouldn't say that humanised our politicians, but what it did do was to remind us that politicians are in essence made of the same DNA in a sense as we are, the same sort of makeup in terms of bones and muscles and all the rest of it, and maybe even occasionally brains.
Yeah, that's excellent. You managed to get someone like him on. I'm just going to move on to questions that have come out of group chats. Scott will have more of them, but I've got one from John for you, Callum. So he says, because you also touched on the, your Celtic commentary, he says, what are your favourite interviews you've done for the bit and best memories from covering Celtic games so far?
In terms of interviews for the book, I particularly enjoyed speaking to Roy Hodgson, just because he's someone who intrigued me in the sense that before he went in at Fulham, you know, his success tended to be abroad. He had great success in Scandinavia. Then he had managed at international level, and it wasn't until the kind of mid-2000s that he got that break, really, with Fulham. Obviously, the spell at Blackburn that didn't go so well, where he then was able to take them to a European final. But I enjoyed him reflecting on what it was like immersing himself in different cultures and learning different languages. And what I found quite interesting about him was, again, it reminded me of Craig Brown in the sense that he was very humble and downplayed all of that. You know, he could speak five or six languages, but to him it was like, oh, no, I don't, I'm not going to blow one trumpet and say, well, I am learned and I know this and that. It was quite, yes, I adapted to certain cultures when I was there, you know, but I worked as hard as anyone else did. And he was really humble, you know, and that's something that came across in the chat with him. And in regards to the Celtic commentary, I have to go, you know, I'm going to go in my first game. It was against Dundee. Mark McGee was the manager. He just came in. Dundee went 1-0 up in the game and Celtic in the end won 3-2. Jorgis Giakoumakis scored a hat-trick and it was just a really dramatic way to start. You know, I got the phone call the week before asking me to meet before the Bodo Glimt game in the Conference League, and I hung up the phone initially because I thought it was a wind-up. I thought there's no way somebody's phoning me asking me to do something for Celtic here. I just couldn't believe it. Thankfully, though, the call came through again. I was told to answer it and met up and everything went well. So I would pick that out as a great memory to start. And then obviously European games have been really good to cover, even if the results haven't been so good. But yeah, no, it's just a privilege to do it, you know. And the best thing for me is interacting with the fans that access the service as well, you know, sharing their stories, and they're not afraid to tell you what they think of a certain player or a certain match or even something that you've said on commentary. You know, they're a great bunch, and it's just a privilege to be able to do it.
So I've got one question and then a follow-up question from some of the podcast members. So Chris was asking, what's gone wrong with your prediction league this season, Callum? And then Erin was asking, do you think she'll win it?
In terms of the prediction league, what's went wrong is I've stopped copying John's scores. That's went wrong. And can Erin win it? Well, if Leicester City can win the Premier League, then Erin can believe.
Yeah, for those who are not aware, there's a few of us who are in a wee predictions league. I won last year, but I'm not doing as well this year. I think that's your problem. If you're copying me, that's where you're going wrong, Callum. But you're doing better than Josh. Not that that would be hard, because Josh is the UK Eurovision Neil Poit.
Some would argue he's became the Darvel of the prediction league. Other clubs are available.
You've just reminded me of a question that was in that chat.
One final question for me, Calvin. Was there somebody who you really wanted and you thought you might be able to get, and it just maybe last minute didn't happen? Or
in terms of that, someone that I would like to interview one day, but not, I didn't think about it for the book, but again, he's older and still currently managing. Someone I'd love to interview would be Claudio Ranieri, you know, for what he achieved with Leicester, given, you know, that amazing story, but also the the stories that he's had working in his native Italy, but also across the continent as well. Someone else that fascinates me, Arrigo Sacchi. I'm absolutely fascinated by him and his background working in the lower leagues, obviously working at Parma and then Milan. I've spoken to a few players that have played for him, and he's another one that I would absolutely love to speak. So I'd pick those two Italians as ones that I would love to have one day.
Yeah, one of the other questions in the group chat, it came from Erin. This can be to both of you. Do you think Freed from Desire is a good song?
If it can motivate, you know, Scotland to victory in Germany with John Bleasdale taking the photograph of us lifting the trophy into the air, I'll be delighted.
I did joke earlier on about waking up from a coma, but I think, just like Callum says, anything that gets a kind of rousing attempt to lift people's resilience, is a word that we've not used in terms of what we've been talking about tonight. But I think, you're asking a man whose musical taste was developed in the 1970s and stuck there. I don't. What is it the young ones are listening to nowadays?
To be fair, the Free From Desire is a 90s classic. It's been remade. It was actually, I think it was a combination of Wigan and Northern Ireland brought it back because of Will Grigg. And it's just went viral around the world. Now Scotland are playing it now and then, which has annoyed one of the members in our group chat, who I won't name. But I think
I'll name him Josh.
I was going to say, if you listen to Monday's podcast, it's pretty clear who that person is.
See, a 90s classic, I was still trying to recover at that point.
Obviously music's going to be a big topic as we count down the Euros. But I'm going to throw in the show, so I wasn't going to do this, but I'm just going to throw it in. I'm sorry if I've not prepared you. I asked this to the Easton Brothers a couple of weeks ago. Scotland are also going to be coming up for the Euros, and asked them what their Scotland team from childhood to now. So I'm going to ask the same to you two. So a seven-a-side Scotland team. So I go whatever formation that you want, just go for it.
Mine's is 95 onwards, and obviously born in 95. So first era that I really remember would be the votes era, in terms of remembering the whole campaign. So I'd probably go for the goalkeeper. I'm going to go Craig Gordon. I'm going to put Craig Gordon in there. Someone who could go to the Euros, you know, the stranger things have happened in football, so I'll go him. I'm going to put Andy Robertson in just for, obviously, returning us to a major tournament, the first major tournament that I really remember. Obviously, I've watched 98 back and the great documentaries made on it, but I was only three, so I didn't get to fully enjoy it as others would have done at the time. So I'll put Robertson in there as well. Centre-back that I'll put in there, I'm going to put in Gary Caldwell, just for the France moment, you know, just put him in there for that. Midfield, I'm going to put Scott McTominay, he's the man of the moment. I'll pop him in there. I'll put Barry Ferguson in for a bit of dig as well, just so that I don't have too much Celtic bias, you know, people saying. So who else would I go for? I've got two left, and my front players, I'm going to put John McGinn as a kind of front player, and I'm going to put in Lyndon Dykes, because he's going to be the top scorer at the Euros in the summer, and he's going to bring the trophy home, and John Bleasdale is going to take that photograph.
Get back out for the final, that is. I've only got 2 weeks. Right, Donald, what's yours?
Right, well, I've got a 20-year advantage, because I go way back to 1973. So I'm going to attempt to do something a little bit different, I suppose. And those that might not have got a Scotland cap, one in particular who I have a connection with. So if I start at the goalkeeper, my favourite Air United player of all time is Dave Stewart, who went on to play for Leeds and got one, I think, Scotland cap. But Alan Ruff, I think, would be my goalkeeper, principally because, although latterly he did sign for Celtic, he did play for the third biggest club in Glasgow for most of his career. Also donned an Air United shirt at one point. In a back three, I think I would probably go for left back, the man who was kept out of the Scotland squad by Danny McGrain, John Spud Murphy, who only played for one club, which was Ayr, and was probably one of the best slide tacklers I have ever seen in my life. And actually, and later in his life, when I was the manager at Cumnock Community College, he fitted our flares. So another connection with the community. Right back, I would probably go for, I'd probably slot in, it's interesting because Kieran Tierney went to school with my stepdaughter. And it's just as well he's probably rich enough to afford an accountant because apparently his maths was shocking. But I'd probably want to put Andy Robertson in somewhere in there. And if I was to choose between Miller and McLeish for the centre of the defence, I'd probably go for Miller because he had slightly more spite. Across the midfield, I'd probably stick a couple of midfielders and one up top. I wouldn't want to go to a Craig Levine 3-3 just in case somebody gave me a hard time. But in the middle, who else are you going to go apart from Souness from that era? But alongside him, I'd like to have somebody who was as daft as a brush and likely to cover every blade of grass and be tackled. And every time he tackled, get back up without shin guards and had resilience. That's Jimmy Johnson. I was fortunate enough to see him. I was going to suggest maybe George Best, given he played for Hibs and we may get him residency, but I don't think rugby rules apply. Up top, it's a real toughie. I can just remember the end of his career, and that's Dennis Law. So between Law and Dalgleish, it's a real... But again, I wouldn't like to miss out of all those. They're all way back in the day. They're not very modern. And, you know, but, you know, between those two, and even Joe Jordan, you know, just for the enigmatic smile he gave against Czechoslovakia. But I'd still go with Dennis Law. There's nobody could beat the Blow Man.
Do you know what, Scott? We'll do ours as well. So I'll go first, right? We'll let the guests off it by doing wins ourselves. So, my goalkeeper would be Andy Gorham, which may surprise some people because I'm an Aberdeen supporter, but I'm taking the red tinted specs off. In my era, 1998 onwards, Gorham was the better goalkeeper of the two. And in 7-a-side football, I think he could get down easier than what Jim would be able to. So that's part of my thinking. But back to, I'm going for a 2-3-1. I'm going to go with Richard Gough because he's just a superb captain centre-back and he could get forward and score goals. And Kieran Tierney for his athleticism, you know, getting up and down that park as well. And there's always going to be one covered, so that's my kind of thinking there. My midfield, I'm going to go John Collins, my favourite Scotland player of all time, just a wonder of a left foot and just such skill and class on the ball. And obviously, he's the penalty taker. I would go with John McGinnon there for his goals because I just think John McGinnon has been absolutely superb in recent years. And my third midfielder, I was torn with this one, but I think for a bit of bite, I would go with Stuart McCall. And he's a good lad as well, Stuart. So I'm going to put Stuart McCall in there. And my striker is going to be James McFadden. Just so many great moments in the Scotland shirt. Even in Scotland teams that weren't particularly great, he was a shining light in it. And even playing up front himself, he did a good job at times. So, yeah, that's my seven. Over to you, Scott J.
We answered this on the group chat now. I can't remember my full team.
I think I might have changed one of mine, actually, from the group chat.
I definitely had Andy Gorman goals because I had a pair of eyes in the 90s and he was far better than Jim Light. And I know people that, but no. Andy Gore was a mercurial talent, and you know, Euro 96 against Holland, he was sensational. So I'll go Andy Gorham. Centre, two defenders, Kieran Tierney as well. I think Kieran Tierney's got the pace, he's got the intelligence, he could play right across, and then Colin Hendry, because you always like a last ditch tackle on a side, you always like somebody to just, and I can't think of anybody better than Colin Hendry during my time of watching Scotland. Midfield is the bit that I can't fully remember. John McGinn I had for his goals. I did consider Stuart McCall because, as you say, he was very tenacious and get the ball. And Let me see. I'll come back to that. I had Neil McCann, but I think I'm going to switch with James McFadden because, you know, McFadden just gave us so many special memories. I had McCann for his pace, but I'm going to just go for special ability and keep... So McFadden will go in there. McCoist is just my hero, so I'm going to pick McCoist for up top. And then I know I didn't pick him during the group chat, and I'm now struggling to think of who I did pick. And now the name's just gone totally out of my head again. Do you know what? Paul McStay. I'm going to put Paul McStay in there because I saw him early 90s and he's such a class act. And, you know, I grew up a Rangers fan, but I could always appreciate somebody who was very, very talented. So Paul McStay, we'll put Paul McStay in midfield.
And the final question, obviously. So, Callum and Donald, you both got your books behind the curtain of A Beautiful Game and back of the net. Where can people expect to buy them?
In terms of mine, you can get it at Morgan Lawrence Publishing. I'm on Twitter at Callum7McFadden. It's the link on the Twitter page, and signed copies are available from the publisher, or if you want me to sign it to you personally, you can contact me for that as well.
And for me, it's available for pre-order through that thing called Amazon, and also from Luath Press, who have got pre-order opportunities for you to pre-order it through there. But it will be, we are hoping, out in most of the bookshops somewhere near you. But online seems to be the best place to get it. So Luath Press would be the best, and we'll have it in our shop as well at www.scottishfootballsupportersassociation.co.uk, I think, but it's probably shorter than that now.
Well, Callum and Donald, thanks very much for coming on and plugging your respective books. We wish you all the best with the sales. And Scott, thanks for adding your knowledgeable contribution as always. You know, you're the book man of the group. You know your stuff, so I'm glad to have you on. And everyone else, thanks for listening. And don't forget, happy football.